wisdom is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, April 30th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
America's infrastructure gets a D. College students could get a break in Obama's new budget, and conservatives accuse Obama of socialism. Plus a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal called Money Changers in the Temple. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Gabrielle and I are off most of this week, and we've been bringing you a reprise of the best of our economic coverage this year. Today, the final part of our four-part economic series. We'll start with a look at the current state of American infrastructure. In monitoring the state of American infrastructure, the American Society of Civil Engineers have assigned an overall grade of D to our crumbling highways, levees, and waterworks. The latest report by the ASCE paints a dismal picture. Since its last report card in 2005, U.S. infrastructure has actually worsened, particularly in the areas of aviation, public transit, and roads. The group monitors 15 areas of infrastructure from waterworks to schools. The highest grade assigned was only a C+ in the area of solid waste. They estimate that a $2.2 trillion investment is needed to dramatically improve American infrastructure. While this recommendation comes at a time when federal coffers are being emptied to bail out the financial industry, it also comes at a time when government job creation is a surefire way to cut unemployment and stimulate the economy. President Obama has promised to invest heavily in American infrastructure, but has faced severe opposition by Republicans leery of more spending. Joining me on the line this morning is the executive director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, Pat Natal. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, and it's an important issue. I'm very glad that you're covering this topic because it is a crisis that we're facing, and we need to be investing in our future. And it's not spending. It's talking about investing.
Well, let's talk about which are the regions that your organization covers. I said there were 15 areas. Can you sort of briefly go through them and point out which are the areas of most concern?
Sure, sure. We have the 15 categories that we evaluated. Of the 15, 11 categories received a D and 4 received a C in that range. The more concerning areas are drinking water with a D-. Drinking water, the quality is very good, but unfortunately a lot of the pipes that are in the ground are old and decaying and rotting, and the good clean water is seeping out into the environment. Not causing any harm to the environment, but you're wasting money and a good resource. Our inland waterways that we use to transport people and goods and services are also a D- and not in good shape because we haven't been taking care of them. Some of our locks are 75 years and older. Another category that is in a very bad shape are levees. You know, we saw the example of what happened in New Orleans, but that's only an example. There are 100,000 miles of levees throughout the U.S., and they are in not the best shape that's required. And part of that problem is a lot of the levees were built at a different time when they were protecting crops. Now they're protecting people when there is a development in those areas, and you need to be built in a different level of protection if they're protecting people, not just crops.
What about wastewater, which I'm imagining can be a source of severe contamination and pollution at a time when people are trying to be more aware of the environment?
You're absolutely right. That's another area which is a D minus. And that drinking water and wastewater, they go hand in hand. We need to be careful that we don't have wastewater spilling into drinking water sources. And we need to properly treat the water before we do dispose of it and dispose of it properly. Again, these systems are old. They've been in the ground for many years. And one of the problems is out of sight, out of mind. People forget about it. until there's a major disaster when something collapses or we end up dumping raw sewage into it to a drinking water source, not in our best interest.
Now, how much worse is this report card than the 2005 card? I mentioned there hasn't been any improvement. It's probably a little bit worse, I'm guessing, just because of time.
A little bit worse. There are signs of things that there has been investments, and we've seen where local areas have improved. I saw a local report card that our group in Texas did this past year, and they showed some slight improvement because there was investment made in some areas where they did raise the grade a little bit. So it's a matter of paying attention. The focus that we want to make sure people do is invest now and control the costs, or do it later when it collapses and it's much more.
So your recommendation from the last report card for how much it would cost to improve the infrastructure, I'm guessing, was significantly less than $2.2
trillion? It was $1.6 trillion, so it went from 1.6 to 2.2. And the reason is because when you don't invest properly, the costs go up.
And I guess for anybody who owns a home and has to do any kind of repair work, you know that if your roof's leaking now, if you wait 5 years to fix it, the cost is just going to go much higher than if you do it right away.
Well, not only the cost, but the damage that is done when it starts leaking and causing damage to your wall,
right,
to your furniture, et cetera, it goes up. It costs, actually, Caltrans came up with an estimate to maintain a facility. If you look at it, costing $1 to maintain it. If you had to replace it because it collapsed, it's $16. 16 times more. And that's a statistics we got from Caltrans.
My guest is Pat Natal, the executive director of the American Society of Civil Engineers. The group has just released the 2009 report card for America's infrastructure, which, by the way, if you're near a computer, you can check it out online at infrastructurereportcard.org. Infrastructurereportcard.org. Right on the front page, you can see the 2009 grades. Let's talk about this figure, $2.2 trillion. I'm sure, you know, as I mentioned, that's a huge number at this time when we don't have that much money. But then again, maybe that's exactly what is needed to do the twofold, to fulfill a twofold purpose, to help create jobs and to improve our infrastructure, something that the president has already been talking about quite a bit.
Great point. Number one, the $2.2 trillion, we have to divide it up and show it. That's over a five-year time period. In addition, there are monies being spent by the feds, by the local government, by state government, that add up to about $1.1 trillion. That includes this part of the stimulus package that did fund some of this up. So the gap is another $1.1 trillion over 5 years. That's a little over $200 billion a year. That's doable with will, with political leadership and will. And we're optimistic that the president has started off on that foot with his message. He was talking about that during the campaign, and he put it into the stimulus package. So we were pleased with that. But we have to get away from the old approach. And the old approach we had was patch and pray and hope that things would get better. Well, no, you have to invest and do it right.
You mean start from scratch on a lot of projects if there are, in terms of just starting over. For example, the levees you had mentioned were built originally for protecting crops. Would you then recommend gutting and starting over from scratch to build something for the purpose which it is now intended?
Not all need to be totally replaced. Some can be repaired, and in fact, the governor in California was putting a major initiative to get funding to look at the levees, mainly in Sacramento, which is has some huge levee concerns up there. So it's just making sure it's done right, and you have to look at case by case. I mean, you look at bridges. We have roughly 600,000 bridges in this country. 27% of them have problems. And it's just, you have to.
Just a disaster waiting to happen, is what you're saying?
Exactly. But the thing is, if we pay attention and do the repairs, and some will require replacement, there was a major bridge in northern Virginia that connects into Maryland, and it was old, and it was a major thoroughfare, Route 95, the major road from Florida all the way up to New England. It was a bottleneck there, and it was a disaster. They totally replaced it, and it was completed last year. So that was an example where replacement was the right way. But other places, You look at the George Washington Bridge in New York. That's a wonderful bridge, as long as it's well maintained. The Brooklyn Bridge, a wonderful bridge, if it's well maintained.
You know, Pat, the sort of ideal reason why people why people put aside their part of their income into taxes. When we think about our taxes, we think about improvements of roads and highways. I mean, that's one of the main reasons why Americans do support taxes, is to keep our infrastructure improved. Well, how do you respond to this rhetoric from Republicans who are leery of spending? We mustn't go on a big spending spree, but isn't that what taxes should be spent on, our infrastructure?
Well, you know, this is not a party issue. I mean, we all ride on the roads, regardless of you're a Democrat, a Republican, or independent. And you look back, the road system we have today was built in the Eisenhower administration. The Eisenhower administration put together the interstate system, which has grown our economy. It was put in for defense purposes, but the impact on the economy, we wouldn't be the great country we were today without the highway system that was put in. The problem is we're still riding on roads built by the Eisenhower administration, and we're sending our kids to schools that were built by the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration.
Let's talk about schools for a moment. I think that's a really important point that you bring up. What do American parents have to be concerned about regarding American schools?
Well, you have schools that are, as I just mentioned, that were built many, many years ago, and if we're not keeping maintenance up, unfortunately, most times when municipalities are trying to control their budget, they cut back on maintenance. And that's when you start having it, the condition get worse. You have schools around the country that inadequate insulation, bad windows, cracks in the walls. They don't have enough classrooms, or they have trailers being used. I don't know how you provide quality education when kids are in classes with coats and hats on.
And you recommend that a significant increase in spending needs to happen, but does that happen at the state level? Does that happen at the federal level? This time, again, we're at a time when, as you said, people want to cut back. Governors want to cut back. They don't want to, oftentimes have the money in the state budget. But, of course, we always seem to have money to bail out, insurance companies like AIG.
Well, again, this is about investing in our future, and it's at all levels. It's not just the federal government. The federal government can't do it alone, but federal government, state government, county government, and the municipality, and the private sector. On the energy system, the private sector needs to be weighing in and investing. Water companies, whether they're municipal-owned water companies or whether they're private companies. An example, we pay a lot of money for bottled water. Wouldn't it be worth to pay a couple cents more a gallon for tap water so we can better maintain our system?
And it would probably be financially more sound for individual pockets.
Absolutely.
Pat, let's talk a little bit about how the United States compares to other industrialized nations on infrastructure spending. I mean, what percentage of our nation's GDP do we spend on infrastructure compared to, say, European countries?
Well, that's a great question, because we're spending in the 2% range, 2% of GDP. Where many other countries are up around 5-6%. They're investing in the future. Now, we were the envy of the world with our infrastructure, because we have good infrastructure. The problem is we just haven't kept up on it. We've thought it would be there forever.
And if you think about, visiting a European country, if you think about the public transit system, for one thing, which is often very obvious, you see state-of-the-art technology, you see well-maintained and clean trains and railroads. What is the state of the mass transit infrastructure of the United States? I mean, we talked about highways, but what about mass transit?
Well, mass transit has some great needs. Rail system in general is a C- and great need. The transit system is a D. We haven't invested a lot in that. One of the things that's exciting in the stimulus package was money to look at high-speed rail. And and they're looking at connecting major metropolitan areas using high-speed rail to get cars off the road and move people quickly.
And that's a big issue in California, too.
A very big issue. And you look at that's very common. In other, I mean, I was in Taiwan 7 years ago, and they were building a high-speed system from one end of the island of Taiwan to the other. Throughout Europe, you get the high-speed rail. I just traveled from D.C. to New York on the Amtrak, which is a high-speed line, and they're looking at upgrading that. That's something being looked into by Congressman Micah from Florida, who happens to be a Republican. So, it's not a party ticket issue. He's looking at encouraging high-speed rail throughout the country and using the Northeast Corridor as an example. So, again, this is about political will and investing in our future. And
now,
if we want to do it, we can do it well.
Pat, the report by the American Society of Civil Engineers that we're discussing, the infrastructure report card, I understand was cited frequently at a recent hearing this week of the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. And you're right, it's not a partisan issue in terms of the fact that, you know, we all benefit when our infrastructure is sound and we all lose when it's not sound. But Republicans and Democrats, according to news reports, disagreed on how to raise the money for this infrastructure. And, you know, there's this sense that, yes, we should pay attention to this report, but all we can afford to do right now is fixing, repairing, maintaining, as you said, sort of just patching things up till we absolutely can't afford to anymore. How optimistic are you that within the next several years infrastructure is going to be improved, or is there going to be another report card a few years down the line by your group that gives it a failing, that gives it grades of F, and the cost is going to run into to the $5 or $6 trillion?
Well, the D level, we don't have far to go to get to the F level, but I think it's possible, and I think there's more and more people getting to understand the needs of it. There's a lot of our congressional leaders are talking about the way out of this. Our report card has examples of success stories where we've invested and the result is improving the quality. This is a quality of life issue, and you talked about that before. You know, if your schools are bad, that's not a good quality of life issue. When people are sitting on roads, congested roads, for longer and longer times every year, that's taken away from their family life. It's not a good thing. When they're not having clean drinking water, that's a health issue. So I think the political will, and more people are getting it. You know, you do get into the rhetoric sometimes when you talk about it, and nobody wants to pay more taxes. But when you need to invest in your future, just like you talked about your home before, it's a matter of looking and prioritizing and making sure you do it right. And sometimes one of the concerns have been we've done things on the cheap. Let's do the cheapest job. Well, maybe doing the more expensive job would last longer.
But
you got to look at life cycle cost, not initial cost.
Pat Natal, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pat Natal is the executive director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, which just released the report card for America's infrastructure. And you can find out more at infrastructurereportcard.org, where you can also find out how you can take action by sharing the report card with your elected officials. That's infrastructurereportcard.org. That interview with Pat Natal aired on March 27, 2009. When we come back, we'll see how college students could see better times under Obama's budget. After that, accusations of socialism from the right and a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We now take a look at how college students are faring in this economy. With the crashing economy making life difficult for many Americans, college students in particular are finding fewer ways to make ends meet. tuition has risen dramatically over the past decade. In California, the average college tuition rose 37% between 2000 and 2007, and last year it rose a whopping 9%. Obviously, wages haven't kept up with this dramatic increase, but neither have financial aid grants. Now, college students across the country may see small relief in President Obama's new budget, which aims at dramatically increasing the number of students eligible for Pell Grants. Government Pell Grants were originally designed to cover 80% of the cost of going to college, but given the sharp rise in tuition, they now cover barely a third of the costs. Obama's budget increases the amount of each grant and also makes funding mandatory. At a time when college students are desperately looking for jobs, college graduates in particular, that just aren't materializing, doing so with a smaller debt burden may ease the economic pain of these trying times. My guest is Eric Lotke, the research director at the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome to Uprising, Eric.
Hello there.
Thanks so much for joining us today. So I mentioned a few stats on how bad it's gotten for college students, in particular the rising tuition, but there's also the rising cost of living in general as well. Can you expand on how tough times are for college kids?
Well, everything's been going up, and it's been going up even as you roll off the numbers for how much it's gone up in the last 5 years, 10 years, depends how you count on which one you're looking at. This is all above inflation, right? So the cost of tuition is rising something like roughly twice as fast as inflation, but then your cost of your food and your room and your board and all of that is going up as well. So the college is basically running out of range of ordinary people. And you see this in things like, I mean, I'm sure people know all of this, but the number of students graduating with more than $25,000 of loan debt has tripled since the early 90s. So people with more than $25,000 worth of loan debt is running up through the roof. And just the general loan debt, you have to turn to banks. Or these days, people can't afford colleges, so they have to go to banks to get the money.
Of course, the rates, then the interest rates are vastly bigger, I imagine, if you turn to banks.
Yes, the interest rates are bigger. And so one,
and you, can you defer your, you know, can you defer the paying off of the loans till you graduate for bank loans as well?
Well, ultimately, you have to pay back the money, and ultimately, you have to pay back the interest. The thing that the Obama budget does, this is what's really new and radical, and the banks are going to come after this one. It's in the budget right now. It's in the House version. It's moving forward. But what the federal government has been doing has been subsidizing banks to make these loans. Now, this was a good idea in the 1960s. In the 1960s, banks would not make loans to students. They're young, they don't have assets, they don't have credit histories, they don't have specific business plans, and they wanted what was back then still a lot of money. And banks wouldn't make those loans, and so the federal government intervened in the economy, and they said, well, banks are sensibly not making loans to these people with no assets, no credit history, so we will make an incentive. We will subsidize the banks to make the loans, and we will guarantee the principal in case of default. That's what the federal government did in 1966. They said, banks aren't making these loans. We need to subsidize them to make the loans. And they did that, and it was necessary. The banks then made the loans. The students went to college, and over the next 20 years, students proved to be excellent credit risks. The banks not only were happy to lend to students, they started competing with each other to lend to students.
And of course,
everybody
that also
wanted to lend to students.
That also led to the increasing credit card debt among students, because now they started marketing credit cards to students.
Everybody started going after the student market, and so the credit card debt is separate. This is more about the cost of college, mm-hmm. and how everything is expensive. The good news debt is the fact that students in 1980 and 1990 were able to get a loan. Then Clinton came along in the 90s, and he said, wait a minute, why are we still subsidizing the banks? Banks are falling all over each other to give students loans for credit cards, for tuition, whatever it is. Banks want to make loans to students. Why are we subsidizing them to do it? And so Clinton first questioned it and created an alternative loan program, which does not subsidize the banks. And then it kind of all stalled during the Bush years. What Obama is now doing is putting this back on track. So he is ending the bank subsidies. The bank subsidies cost something like $5 billion a year. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, scores it at closer to $10 billion a year. This is money that is going to banks. It is direct federal money, taxpayer money, going to banks, paying them to make loans to students.
Of course, at a time when we have this recession, the banks are counting on those subsidies, but the subsidies were intended to offset risks, so they're not really doing what they're intended to do.
They are not needed at all anymore. They're just plain not needed. And so what the Obama budget does is kind of rewinds history and says, wait a minute, what are we doing here? Let's stop subsidizing the banks. Now, this is not about TARP and bailouts and all the rest of it. We could argue whole separately about that whole bank bailout. This is something that's just been in the budget for all of these years, that the banks are getting roughly $5 billion a year from the government, federal government. And so what Obama says is no. The Obama budget stops the subsidies for the banks. Now there's $5 billion that was previously being spent on education. And now the Obama budget says, well, we're still going to spend this money on education. We're not going to give it to the banks. We're going to give it to the students.
So just directly to the students themselves in the form of grants rather than loans?
There is federal lending going on as well, and the federal lending exists. It is being amplified. It will increase. So federal lending will continue to go on, and banks can get money from the federal treasury at a lower interest rate than they can get money from the banks. So that's all good. So the federal lending, direct lending, will continue and will be expanded. And then separately from that, there's money going into the Pell Grants, which are grants. That's a gift. That is money that the federal government is putting into students' pockets. And in this case, it's getting the money directly from the banks. And the federal Pell Grant is going up under the Obama budget up to $5,500 a year next year.
Per grant. So rather than giving a gift to banks, the budget, as it's designed, could give a gift to students to learn.
That's exactly
and,
what it
is. And this is taxpayer money, and students, of course, being taxpayers and their parents and families. So it certainly seems like a great way to, you know, from the perspective of students and people who believe in education at a time when the educational system is becoming so out of reach as well. Let's also talk specifically about where what you expect to happen to this aspect of the budget as it makes its way through Congress. The banks will oppose it and will lobby hard. Are they going to be strong enough, and what do you see among Republicans and Democrats in terms of whether they agree on this aspect of the budget?
Right. The banks will come after it hard. You are exactly right. And so far, this is not getting – the opposition to this change is not getting a lot of traction, so that at present, this language from the Obama budget, it's in the House, it's in the Senate. People aren't really questioning it. But the budget is being questioned in a lot of ways. People are looking at it and saying, why is Uncle Sam spending all of this money? Look at the size of these deficits and all the rest of it.
And this is also not a very good time to come to the defense of banks, given how much money they're already getting.
Right, which is fine, because we shouldn't be coming to the defense of banks. The question is, should this $5 billion go to students? Right? Maybe it could go to deficit reduction. Maybe it could go to tax cuts. Maybe it could go to all different things that people are going to start pulling out. And what we're saying is, this is what the federal government should be doing. This is why we have a government. People come together and they do things that are for the public good. And students need help to go to college. And everybody wins if we have more people going to college. It's better for the economy, it's better for the student, it's better for all of us, because one of those guys is going to invent something someday. But of course,
it's not necessarily better for banks. My guest is Eric Lotke, Research Director of the Campaign for America's Future. We just have a few minutes left. Eric, let's talk about just reminding listeners, we talked a little bit about how hard it's gotten for students. As this economy continues to shrink, the help may not come fast enough for many students who are opting out of university education and trying to get any job just to keep food on the plate or stay in their apartment. How fast do you think students can expect this relief, and how severe is the struggle today? I understand that enrollment rates are falling.
enrollment rates are falling and costs continue to rise. This Pell Grant program would go into the next school year's programs. So it's as early as this September, right? Because it's now March or April of 2009, and so this can pass as early as this September, mm-hmm. is when we start getting the increases in grants, and then they stabilize. The other thing that the Obama budget does, which is visionary, is that the Pell Grants, you said this in the intro, it used to be 77% of a Pell Grant would cover 77% of the cost of college. Now it's down to roughly 35% of the cost of college. So the Pell Grant has lost half of its value just because of inflation, and because Pell Grant hasn't been increasing as fast as inflation, and college has been increasing faster than inflation. So the Pell Grant has been cut in half. So the Obama budget gives it a bump up to $5,550 next year. That's partly the bank subsidies that do it. And then what it does is it increases it annually thereafter at inflation plus 1%. So inflation plus 1%, and it makes it a permanent fixture in the budget, so that instead of every year the Pell people have to go back to Congress and beg for more, and most years they don't succeed, and every few years they get a small bump up, but it doesn't quite keep up with inflation. This is being put into the permanent part of the budget that just kind of happens automatically, that the Pell Grant program will be renewed. You don't have to go back and beg for it again, and not only that, but it will be renewed at inflation plus 1%.
Erica, so do you recommend people who are excited about this aspect of the Obama budget to lobby there and to pressure there and call their congressional representatives to keep this part of the budget intact?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great idea. The whole budget's going to come under fight, and people need to support their elected officials who want to do this. Defend this Pell Grant change in particular. Defend this changing of public money from going from the banks to the students. Defend that in particular. And the entire budget is going to come under attack, and the people who support these changes in alternative energy and college tuition and all the rest of it need to let their support be known, because the people who oppose these changes are certainly letting their opposition be known.
And more information can be found at your group's website, which is at?
OurFuture.org. OurFuture.org.
OurFuture.org. Eric Lotke, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Lotke is Research Director of the Campaign for America's Future. Again, more information at ourfuture.org. That interview with Eric Lotke was recorded on March 30th, 2009. After a short break, we'll come back with a look at Obama being accused of socialism and a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We'll now rebroadcast an interview with Tim King about socialism and whether or not Obama is practicing it. President Obama has come under increasing criticism from conservatives for some of his economic policies. Reminiscent of the campaign-era rhetoric from the right, Obama is being accused of being a socialist, from Newt Gingrich to Rush Limbaugh and a good portion of the right-wing blogosphere. One blogger warned, personal freedom, individual liberties, and self-determination are evaporating as fast as stocks, and most retirement accounts, rules, regulations, and restrictions will soon be rampant, government will soon be unbridled, uncontrolled, and uninhibited. We will have to learn for ourselves that socialism simply doesn't work. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, addressing the Conservative Political Action Conference, recently denounced the formation of so-called socialist republics in the United States. There is a conversation about socialism in the media. Newsweek had a dramatic cover story called We Are All Socialists Now. But Tim King, executive news editor of SalemNews.com, asserts it is questionable whether most of the accusers even know what socialism is. Tim King joins me on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about the accusations themselves, most of them, as I said, coming from people like Rush Limbaugh, commentators in the conservative and mainstream media, but also, of course, Republican lawmakers themselves. Do their accusations hold any water?
I don't know if in part you could connect some of the policies that Obama's bringing forth to socialism, but you know what I hear is another layer of paranoia from the GOP, and it's like the WMD thing. I mean, these guys are going to throw what they can at the fan and see what sticks, and you know the irony is that socialism, no one even really understands what that is or how a country could, for many decades, you know, maintain a small policy which was socialist in nature, but never have it spiral out of control as, you know, the people that you mentioned, like Limbaugh, continue to suggest. So, you know, a minor aspect of that in Obama's politics, maybe, but is the country going socialist? Absolutely not. And if you look at, you know, just look around a little bit at some of the active socialist networks, and none of them even lay a hand on Obama. They don't claim to have any connection with him. So,
well, some would argue that we are already a socialist country in some aspects. We have, some aspects of, you know, our police force is socialized, the fire department is socialized, et cetera.
Social security would mm-hmm. be a great example, right? And I've been, you know, that was an FDR New Deal thing, and but you know the Socialist Party of America was certainly behind it, and you know they've, if you study their history, they've had a very tough go here, and certainly the Cold War increased the pressure on the American Socialist Party so much that they almost ceased to exist. In fact, they did, I think they disbanded in 70 or 73 for the first time out. But I had just one after another comment being left on that story yesterday, and emails flowing into our newsroom, and you know, there are so many countries that use these policies effectively right above us in Canada. And I really see a degree of paranoia with you know, these guys over on the right side of the aisle that, you know, they're trying to scare people more than anything when you're talking about something that, in fact, can make life much better for people from what we're seeing from our research.
And it's interesting because there are, some of the accusations are veiled. A favorite comparison these days is France. Oh, we're all going to be like France. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, well, let's go all the way back to WMDs and France. You know, remember that
the French have become like a favorite punching bag, it seems.
They have. And no one has the accurate history. From World War One, between 1914 and 1919, the birth rate in France dropped by 1.2 million people. Nobody really in any Western country has seen the degree of war that France has. And I've spent time in France researching different periods of history, and they've really, really paid their dues. When Iraq was going on, Bill O'Reilly sent out an email saying, why would the French support America? They've never had to fight for anything anyway. And it's that kind of just, you know, direct tragic lie that distorts everything so much, people have a very hard time figuring it out.
Now, you don't often enough perhaps hear the comparisons to Russia, but I did mention that Mike Huckabee talked about the formation of socialist republics in the United States, perhaps an allusion to the former USSR. Is this comparison at all valid?
Absolutely not. I don't see anything at all. And we also have to remember the word socialist has been used falsely time and time again. The Nazis, the National Socialist Party. I don't think there was anything resembling our health care plan on the tables of the Nazis. And, you know, Poland, another country, absolutely communist behind the Iron Curtain throughout the Cold War, but only using the term socialist. It's like George W. Bush using the term freedom. It's ironic, and it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody at all.
So you mentioned the Socialist Party of America, and you know many of our listeners have heard of Eugene Debs. Can you give our listeners some history of the Socialist Party in the United States, and whether it practiced or at least preached the socialism that you think is an authentic socialism?
Well, again, I think that it's just going to be a different application every time, probably, that somebody or some nation uses the term. But everything that I'm seeing right now, not going to Debs, but going to the current arrangement, is there's a strong alliance or alignment with democracy. You don't find anything about communist ideals. You don't find anything about Marxism. You find, a philosophy that wants to prevent all of the weight of the money going to the top tiers of any, you know, corporate group, and they want, obviously, workers to have a much, much bigger say in anything to do with, you know, contract labor negotiations. They just are, you know, it's a party of distribution, and the paranoid aspect is, you know, private business disappearing and this and that. I find it interesting that when the Olympics came around, China, where, you know, it's been communist for so long, and we have Tiananmen Square, and we have, you know, so many instances of conflict, but that was perfectly okay with the United States government and the Bush administration. Why is it okay to work with socialist countries or communist countries and then turn around and lay this type of view on them? I mean, I just think that it's all being done as a matter of political maneuvering by the right wing, and that even if socialist policies do continue to come forth, that they can be kept at a certain point and not spiral out of control.
My guest is Tim King. He's a former U.S. Marine with 20 years of experience on the West Coast as a television news producer, photojournalist, reporter, and assignment editor. He has been a war correspondent and is now the executive news editor of SalemNews.com, where you can read his newest article we're discussing that was published yesterday, Accusations of Socialism Against Barack Obama. That's Salem-News.com. You know, it's interesting, Tim, when you hear the right wing be fearful of the specter of socialism, which has been turned into this dirty word. I quoted one blog that was worried about personal freedom, individual liberties, and self-determination evaporating as fast as stocks and most retirement accounts. And yet some of those same people think that it's perfectly fine for personal freedom, individual liberties, and self-determination to evaporate when we're talking about protecting ourselves from terrorism, if you will, and they justify homeland security and the infringement on civil liberties.
It's been so difficult. You know, I don't believe that there's anything imaginable that Barack Obama could have brought forth as a president that wouldn't draw the same fire, that would just draw a variant. You know, they would shift it around. But as he, you know, when they watched this happen, I think it was so incredible to people from the right wing that we could actually do this. And to me, it and I'm not backing Obama, but it restores the soul of America to a degree that they are able to elect a minority president at this point. It says so much about all of the goodness about this country, and it's an opportunity for people to be able to, you know, drop the political rhetoric and drop the extreme political positions. But instead, all it seems to be doing is emboldening these factions that are so intent on division in our country. It's very sad. It's certainly not the country that I remember growing up in even 10 years ago, let alone 20. And, I've in Afghanistan, you mentioned that I'm a war correspondent, and that's true. And if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at pictures during the communist years, you will find a country, and I'm not advocating for communism, I'm just laying out a historical fact. You'll find a nation that was at peace. Maybe it was under communist rule, and religion was somewhat suppressed, but women had rights, and everything was different. You go there today, and it's the most incredible war zone. It's dangerous. It's disease-ridden. And so how can they say that everything about this side of life is so bad? I see, you know, again, degrees of communism or socialism being applicable, and, you know, people need health care or there's no solid workforce, which, again, it's an ironic situation because the right wing is so intent on people paying their way. But if they're sick, how can they pay their way? I mean, it's a really hard one to figure out sometimes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Barack Obama himself. I mean, the New York Times had an interview with him recently that is getting a lot of attention, where the reporter just asked out, "Are you a socialist?" As some people have said, Media Matters, the watchdog group, has criticized the question, saying that the Times has effectively endorsed the divisive right-wing rhetoric. But in fact, you know, is in your view, looking at what Obama is currently doing in passing the economic stimulus package, how close are his policies to authentic socialism?
I don't think very close. It's all so interpretive. I mean, mm-hmm. Government rushing in, you know, the way it's going, I mean, we're practically nationalizing some of this already, so that certainly would be akin to socialism, but I don't really see a comparison. I see a terribly broken system that a new president, a young president, a motivated president, has basically inherited. And I think everyone knew that it was going to be this difficult. And there are no good answers when you inherit something that's thoroughly broken.
And when one has to regulate something that has been deregulated and as a result broken, if that is interpreted as socialism, does it matter even?
It is deregulation. I mean, I really, that's the first thing that pops into my mind when I think about this. And, you know, the irony of smaller government being a chant and a call, while the group again restricts freedom through homeland security and, you know, stands firmly against a woman's right to choose and all these things. It's just, it's really hard to figure out where they're coming from. And then you've got the whole religion factor that comes in on top of that. You might realize that the GOP's really only tried to align itself with religion since the 1980s. That used to always be, you know, the Democratic side that really spoke of religion more often. And that, you know, when they figured that out and turned that around, it's been a real moneymaker for them. And so I guess you can't blame the party on one hand for trying to bolster its position. It certainly has done that.
Well, and on the issue of religion, of course, we are told that the sort of rewriting of Christianity is that God is a capitalist and that the pursuit of one's own wealth is the highest calling. This is interesting to see how it'll play out. Tim King, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been very pleasant. I appreciate the time. And thank you for, expanding on this for your listeners, because it's a very important subject.
Tim King is the executive news editor of SalemNews.com. You can read his article online at salem-news.com. That interview with Tim King aired on March 10, 2009. And finally, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Money changers in the temple. For readers of the Bible's New Testament, few stories illustrate the anger of Jesus of Nazareth better than that of his expulsion of the money changers from the temple. For they have, in his words, changed it into a den of thieves. This event is memorable, for it shows him not speaking in anger, but acting. Some artists have depicted him actually whipping money changers out of the temple as they flee amidst chaos. That imagery was borrowed several millennia later when U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made his famous Fear Itself inaugural address. As the country fell under the deep freeze of depression, Roosevelt spoke words that were recognized by many of that age when he said, "The rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Roosevelt continued, "The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit." Those words were spoken on January 20th, 1933. That was 76 years ago. And once again, the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed, and the nation is gripped by the icy chain of depression. Yeah, I said depression. For just 6 months ago, the president assured the country that the state of the economy was sound, even as the nation was locked in a recession for most of the year. If it ain't a depression, it's a dime's distance away from it. But this ain't 33. The money changers who steered the economy onto the rocks haven't admitted defeat. They're making more money. Indeed, they are given taxpayers' money as they burn through more. The more they lose, the more they want. These money changers aren't being whipped out of the temple. They're given bigger tables. Look at AIG, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup. Not just mo money, but mo, and mo money. Because in the eyes of Washington and the Federal Reserve, they're too big to fail. Under that illogic, they will swallow the moon and get bigger while the nation's economy worsens by the hour. Welcome to the Temple of Thieves. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal was recorded on March 9th, 2009, and you can find out more about his commentaries as well as listen to all of them online at www.prisonradio.org. And that does it for today's show. Tomorrow I'll be back live on the air after having traveled to the East Coast for a couple of conferences about the war in Afghanistan. I hope to have some interviews from my trip to play on the show from a New York conference on peace and development in Afghanistan. Also, there is a conference on Afghanistan happening right here in Southern California on Sunday, May 3rd, which you may have heard being promoted on KPFK. Is Afghanistan Becoming Obama's Iraq is the title of the day-long conference. It's happening from 1 to 6 p.m. at USC's Taper Hall, and it features speakers, films, workshops, and action plans about the war in Afghanistan. I'll be a speaker at the conference in addition to Tom Hayden and many others. KPFK is a media sponsor of the event, and you can find out more about this May 3rd conference at www.kpfk.org. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to www.pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.